Well, Dick's in a bad mood. I'm in a good mood. And I tell you why. I fly a lot, so when I flew from Billings from DFW, I got this email, which I get maybe, I don't know, once a year, that because I'm such a great customer of American Airlines, they upgraded me to first class. And I never would pay for first class because you pay to sit in a nice comfy chair that you can sit in at home for free, right? But it just cost a heck of a lot more. Then I got to the hotel yesterday, and I went in my room. The heater didn't work. And when you are in Montana, you want the heater to work in your hotel room. So I went down to the desk. They sent somebody up, and they says, "Yeah, your heater doesn't work." So I went down, and they says, "You know, we're going to have to change rooms, but we're all out of rooms except for our luxury suite." So I'm in a good mood because something good is happening here. Okay, and then I just got email this morning that I'm upgraded to first class going back to DFW, so things are going very good. Well, I want to talk today about, by the way, you know what Dick mentioned is true. My wife and I noticed every time before I went out and gave a speech, we got in a fight. And we decided it was spiritual warfare. Huh? Never happens at your house. Yeah, we got into a fight. And it was, I don't know about your marriage, but oh, we fight about such trivial things. And we got to the point where we started to get in a fight before before an event. And we said, oops, spiritual warfare. So we just stopped, said a prayer, and it worked out really good. I have some advice for you. If you ever get into a fight and you are you're grumpy and you and you walk down the hall and all of a sudden it hits you. I'm a jerk. Anybody ever have that in their minds? Okay. Here's something you can use, because I've done this with my wife twice. I took a deep breath. I turned around. I went back in the room and said, "Honey, I just saw my evil twin brother walking down the hall. Has he been bad to you?" And she laughed, and I laughed, and it was great. We have a great sense of humor. We were going down the road one time, and she had a hot cup of coffee, and I was going over a bumpy road, and she said, "Honey, slow down." And I said, "Look, I'm an engineer." I said, "Just hold out your hand. It'll act like an absorber of the vibrations, and I don't want to slow down." And she said, "Okay," and then she reached over and she put the hot cup of coffee right over my lap. So we have a good time. So let me talk about some of the things that the topic that we're going to do. It's the mind-body question. Are you a materialist made out of meat? If you are a naturalist or you're a materialist, you have to believe that you are a computer made out of meat. We talked about this in my talk about artificial intelligence. But this has been a debate which has gone on in the area of philosophy and other places for years and years and years, going back to Descartes and even before him. Now, they didn't talk about the mind-body. Descartes called it the soul. Is the soul greater than the brain? And do you think the soul is greater than the brain? Yeah, I think it probably is. So this went on in philosophy for years and years and years until recently. And more recently, now we're starting to garner scientific evidence that indeed the mind is more than the brain. It's more than that glob of meat that you have between your ears. And that's what I want to talk about today. One of my favorite comedians is Emo Phillips. Anybody ever listen to Emo Phillips? I think he is the funniest comedian in the world. If you haven't seen Emo Phillips, he's weird, but his humor is just incredible. One of his Christian jokes is, you know, "I used to go to church and I wanted a bicycle, so I prayed and prayed and prayed for a bicycle. And then after going to church for a long time, I realized that's not the way it worked. So I stole a bike and I prayed for forgiveness." Okay, read Emo Phillips' jokes. They are just incredible. Here's one of his quotes which is relevant here. He said, "I used to think that the brain was the most wonderful organ in my body. then I realized who was telling me this. So this was very interesting, and this is humorous, but it's also this idea that us humans have, that we have the ability to go outside of ourselves and analyze ourselves, and I don't think that any other animals can do that, any other mammals can do that. We have that unique ability to go outside ourselves and judge ourselves, and that's exactly what he did in this humor. So let me talk about four things here today. I'm going to talk first of all, what is consciousness? Here's one thing that happens in the media. They start talking about words and they never define the words. What is consciousness? They say that artificial intelligence is someday going to be conscious. They're using what I refer to as seductive semantics, because it seduces you into thinking about the word in terms that you're familiar with, and it might not be what they're familiar with. Politicians use this all the time. That's the reason a great politician can come in and they can give a speech and say, we're going to make America great again. I shouldn't have said that. They say things like, we need to increase the economy. We need to increase jobs. We need to do this. We need to do that. And everybody from the left to the right thinks, man, that's just perfect. So they use seductive semantics, and everybody interprets it in their own way, so that the politician is very very good. So we have to define seductive semantics. So I'm also going to talk about neuroscience, and I have some good friends that are neuroscientists, and one that I've learned a lot from is a guy named Michael Ignor. Michael Ignor is the chief of neurosurgery at Stony Brook. And he is coming out with a book, and I recommend it. I forget the title, but he is just an incredible lecturer. I'm going to talk about the idea of abstract thoughts, and then what I think is the most compelling part of the talk, near-death experiences. So let's talk about consciousness. What does consciousness mean? Consciousness, there's different theories about it, and nobody really defines what consciousness is. I know that I'm conscious. I'm really not sure about Dick, okay? I think you're conscious, aren't you? Yeah, you're getting there, okay. So, this is very interesting, having to define this just from the perspective of my realization. So here are the theories for consciousness. One is panpsychism. Panpsychism says that there's things in the universe like mass and energy and things of that sort. Maybe consciousness is just part of the universe, just like mass and energy, and that everything has a bit of consciousness. So according to panpsychism, this little clicker here has a small degree of consciousness. This is their theory. And we are lucky because we have amassed a lot of consciousness and are really conscious. So they believe it's just a force of nature. It's here, which is kind of weird. There's also the idea of emergence. The people in artificial intelligence believe in emergence. They believe that as things become more and more complicated, that eventually we are going to have a consciousness which emerges from this complexity. And that's what they believe. It's going to be magic. It reminds me of the little boy who went into a big room full of horse manure, and he got all excited, and he started to take the manure and take it and look at it, throw it over his shoulder, and he was digging in it. And they asked him, why are you so excited? He said, with all this horse manure in here, there must be a pony in here somewhere. So he was very excited about that, and that's the way it is with emergence. With all of this complexity, there must be a consciousness in there somewhere. There is absolutely no evidence in the world that emergence happens with complexity. There's a guy at University of Wisconsin who, what's his name? Okay, doesn't matter, but he has put forward this idea of integrated information theory, which is a model of consciousness which basically has to do with the complexity of a system. It's kind of like emergence. Then there is the Sims theory. This is a theory which is prescribed to by Elon Musk. He believes that we're all computer simulations, just like the little computer games that we play. We are the elements of a computer game that some master programmer has programmed. And in fact, I read this on the web, so it has to be true. Musk has put out a team of people that are trying to go around and try to find evidence that we are simulations. You remember the movie Truman? Have you seen the movie Truman, where that big thing falls out of the air? It goes zoom, and he says, oh, man, there must be something else. These people are trying to look for the equivalent of something falling out of the air and saying, you know, there's something weird happening here that is evidence that indeed we are simulations. There's the idea of quantum consciousness. What is this? Well, you remember I said that we are non-algorithmic and that I got a lot of my ideas from Roger Penrose in some of his book. Well, Roger Penrose is a naturalist. So he thought, okay, I believe that people are non-algorithmic, but is there something in nature that exists which is non-algorithmic? The only thing that he could get to which was non-algorithmic is in something called quantum mechanics, which is a so-called quantum collapse. And with quantum collapse, it's non-algorithmic. You cannot predict anything. You cannot write a computer program to dictate what happens with quantum collapse. So as a naturalist, this was his only out. This was his only out, was quantum mechanics. And he said there must be a way out. He joined forces with an anesthesiologist named Hammerhoff. They came up with something called the Oort-Oer theory. And it is a theory that consciousness some way emerges from quantum mechanics. This was proposed maybe 20 years ago. It has developed absolutely zero traction. Philosophers still talk about it a little bit, but it really has no traction at all. And then there is the idea that theists believe, and I think as a Christian that I believe, that which is mind-brain dualism, that there is an aspect of the mind which is external to the brain which connects us to God. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit. So that's consciousness theory. I want to talk next about neuroscience and some of the interesting things that happen in the brain. This is from Michael Ignor. He's the neurosurgeon. There was, they do brain operations and they cut a flap out of your skull and there's no neurons in your brain. No neurons. No, there's no sense of pain. What word am I thinking of? Okay, there's no sense of pain in your brain. You can touch your brain and there's no sense of anything. But they can touch the brain and elicit different responses from you. So one of the neurosurgeons decided to do an experiment. And he touched a part of the brain and the person did something like that, wiggled their hand. And that was interesting. And then the neurosurgeon said to the patient, every once in a while, I just want you to wiggle your hand like that. And so they went on, the patient wiggled their hand, and he went on, and then he touched the part of the brain, and the patient waved his hands, and the patient said, you did that. So the patient was able to differentiate between the surgeon making him do that and his own free will making him do that. I thought that was just a fascinating, fascinating result. There's free won't. This is really weird. There was a neurosurgeon named Libet who did an experiment, and he found out that there was a little signal that happened in your brain that told you what you wanted to do before you knew it. Think about that. A little signal in your brain that says you're supposed to do that, and then less than a second later, you thought, oh, I want to do that. Now, it sounds like a contradiction of free will, doesn't it? But what Libet discovered is that people could actually have this little inclination and they could say, no, I don't want to do that. They could take this and negate it. And Libet called this not free will, but free won't. I used to smoke cigarettes a long, long time ago. And I tell you, there were a lot of signals in my brain that says, you want a cigarette, so I had a cigarette. You want a cigarette, I had a cigarette. You want a cigarette, I want a cigarette. Then I decided to smoke. My wife says, no kids as long as you smoke. So I wanted kids, so I had to quit smoking. So I had a little signal in my brain and it says, you want a cigarette, and I exercise free won't. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And then There was another signal in my brain, you're going to have a cigarette? No, I won't do that. And pretty soon, there's something in the brain that happens called neuroplasticity, which actually rewires the brain so that those paths of these inclinations begin to disappear. But they never totally disappear. That's the reason Alcoholics Anonymous always says, oh, you know, just one drink and you're back in the path. And when I quit smoking, it was you're a puff away from a pack a day. So if you took one cigarette, you would be back on it. Now, my desire to smoke has totally gone away. But even today, I get on an airplane, and I'm old enough to remember when it was okay to smoke on airplanes. And there used to be this bell, this little ding that went off after you took off that allowed you to smoke cigarettes. And I would always wait for that little ding, and I would take out a cigarette and I would smoke. But even today, I get on the plane, and there's this ding, fasten your seatbelt signs, and there's this vague feeling inside that I want to smoke a cigarette. It's just very curious, and it's very vague, and it's very far away, but it's still there. So I maintain even after, oh, let's see, 1980, I don't know, 40, 43 years of not smoking, I still have that little path, which has diminished a lot, but is still there to a degree. And I still exercise free won't. Here's another interesting thing. If you had two brains and you believed that the mind is part of the brain, if you had two brains, you would have two minds, wouldn't you? Yeah, the answer is yes. Well, it turns out that neurosurgeons, including my friend Michael Ignor, does something called corpus callosotomies. Better known as a split brain operation. He will go into for a neural operation and he will separate totally the left brain hemisphere from the right brain hemisphere. He'll just slice right down the middle. Now, why does he do that? He does that for epileptics because what they found out is that sometimes there is a signal on one side of the brain that communicates to the other side of the brain to have a seizure. And what they do by doing the split brain operation is they disrupt that path of communication so that people no longer have a seizure on the other side. You would think this would be incredibly disruptive. And I would hate to have been the first patient they tried this on because I don't know what the heck would happen. But here's what they found out. Yes, it does arrest the seizures. The seizures go away. But the person emerges as the same person that went in the operation. There's one person that comes out of that operation. There's not two people, one corresponding to each side of the brain. There's one person. Now, there's some side effects, of course, but nevertheless, only a single person emerges from that split brain operation, which is, I think, evidence. It's not proof, but I think it's evidence that the mind is greater than the brain, because now you essentially have two brains. So that's neuroscience. Now I'm going to talk about something which is, for me initially, was a little bit difficult to grasp. I hope I have the art to explain this to you in a convincing manner. And that is the idea of abstract thought. And what is abstract thought? That's what we're going to talk about that next. We have thoughts about things in reality, like eight eggs. But those things in reality, because of time, are eventually going to be reduced to a pile of ashes, right? It's something which is temporary, which is going to eventually become a pile of ashes. Yet we have other thoughts that don't go away. And I'll give you a very simple example, the number eight. We all have an idea of what the number eight is. Now, I'm not talking about eight eggs, eight chairs, eight people, but just the number eight in itself. It's an idealization and it's an abstract thought that really has no idea in reality. There was a Bell system scientist, Richard Hamming, who said, I try to explain to people the idea that you have eight eggs and you have eight people and both of them correspond to the number eight. I think that is fascinating. Now, we're so numbed by familiarity. I'm so numbed by familiarity. I have a hard time relating to Hamming's astonishment. We're kind of numbed by familiarity, but the idea of the number eight is an abstract thought. According to Michael Ignor, there is no mapping in the brain for abstract thought. We can also think, here's another example. We can think of a building, kind of a pyramid, that eventually will return to ashes. We also have an idea of a triangle. We're all familiar with the triangles, but that triangle, that ideal triangle, does not exist, the ideal triangle that you have in your brain. You cannot write down an ideal triangle, because whatever you write down, the pencil width is going to be finite. It's not going to be an ideal triangle. It's something which is an abstract thought that you have. Now, here's the thought from philosophers, and the more I think about it, the more compelling it is. You, as a person, will eventually decompose, right? You'll be a pile of ashes also. But you know what? You have abstract thoughts. You have the ability to conceive of things which really don't exist in reality. The number eight does not exist in reality. And if everybody in the world died, there would still be the number eight. The number eight is not going to go away. You're not going to have headlines one day that says, mathematicians have discovered that the number of eight no longer exists. And therefore, we have to just deal with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11. We just can't use 8 anymore. No, 8 is an abstract thought which is going to be there independent of you, independent of everybody. It's going to be an abstract thought that exists. We have the capability of those abstract thoughts. The same thing with an ideal triangle. Now, here is the argument. The argument is, if we have these abstract thoughts, then we ourselves must be abstract. To have an abstract thought, you yourself must have a part of you which is abstract. And that abstract thing, just like the number eight, just like the idea of an ideal triangle, never disappears. So you are going to exist forever, just like the number eight, just like the triangle. That was pretty heavy, but let's get into something which is more interesting and more transparent. I don't know if it's more interesting. These are all interesting, but we're going to talk about near-death experiences. What is a near-death experience? A near-death experience is what happens when somebody dies and they are brain dead, they are body dead. There's no brain activity. There's no physiological activity. You are just dead. And you are dead for a prolonged period of time, a half hour, an hour, or something like that, and then you wake up. So you are dead in all sorts of ways. In fact, doctors many times prescribe people who have died, had near-death experiences. They say, this person is dead, and they sign off on the death certificate, and boom, you know, the person comes back. These people have experiences which are just astonishing. And we only know about it from the last 50 years, because in the last 50 years, the medical arts have risen to such a degree that we can now revive these people. It used to be we didn't revive these people as much. So we have lots of data within the last 50, 100 years about these near-death experiences. And the people that come back from these near-death experiences have just astonishing revelations. Their lives are changed. They say that what their near-death experience is beyond description, that they do not have the words to explain their experience in this near-death experience. They say it's a clear reality, it's not a dream. If you have a dream like me, you think about the dream and say, oh, I did this and this and this, and then you think about 5 seconds later and you said, what was I thinking about? Those dreams just kind of disappear into an ether, right? No, this is reality. They believe that what they experienced was reality. And it is not just a vague dream. It is an experience of reality, just like we're experiencing now. They have a sensory explosion. They see colors that they've never seen before. And how do you explain a color that you've never seen before? And so their ability to explain the near-death experience is beyond explanation. They have feelings of unspeakable joy. That is those that go to the front porch of heaven, Now, there are those that go to the front porch of hell, too, and we'll talk about that. That's a little bit chilling. They feel unconditional love. This is something which is a common denominator in a lot of these near-death experiences. This is a string that ties together all the beads. They just feel this astonishing feeling of love. They feel timelessness. Now, I think the scripture says, in many cases, before the beginning of time, right? And that means that God exists outside of time and space. And if God exists outside of time and space, he's not encumbered by time. He's not encumbered by space. The people that come back from these near-death experiences are not encumbered by time or space. Timelessness. They have a life review. You've heard of people saying that when I die, I have my life flash before my eyes. You've heard of that. As people die. This is true in many of the cases, not all the cases, but many of the cases that is indeed true. They have a life review. They meet deceased loved ones. And we'll talk about that more in a second, but they meet people who have died. Never do they meet somebody who is already alive, who is alive when they died. They always meet people that have died. There's always a hesitation to return. Many of these people say, this is such a wonderful experience that I don't want to come back to the world. And their lives are changed. This is captured very nice in a book called Imagine Heaven by John Burke. John Burke is a Christian. He's a pastor, so he goes through near-death experiences from a Christian point of view. And he has a book called Imagine Heaven, where he talks about that. He also has a sequence of videos on YouTube that I would highly recommend, because it's one thing to read about people with near-death experiences. It's totally different when you hear them talk about it. You can see their feelings, and you can see that they believe what happened. I'm going to play a couple of videos here. Let's see if we have the audio going here. Oh, that's right. I have to go up here to do this, don't I?
Overwhelming. Easy or glory, was it?
It was.
Take us back.
It was difficult.
You were run over by an 18-wheeler.
I was. Over in East Texas, I was on my way home from a Bible study, or a pastor's conference, to do a Bible study in Alvin, south of Houston. So I was about 130 miles away. It was a cold, rainy January day, and I got in the car. I'm headed home. I'm headed to my church, and I was on a bridge I'd never been on before, and before I got off the bridge, an 18-wheeler crossed the center stripe and hit me head-on. Probably 110 miles an hour of impact. I was killed instantly. Blunt force trauma, brain damage, impaled on the steering wheel. The dashboard collapsed on my legs, right leg broken. At the knee, and the left leg was severed just above the knee. 4.5 inches of femur was ejected from the car and never found. I put my hand up when the truck was coming for me. At the moment, the truck ran over me, and it took my left arm into the back seat of the car. And from here forward was lying on the back seat of the car. So, horrific accident. There was nothing that could have been done to save me. They tried, met the paramedics. There were two other vehicles struck after my car. Vehicles, a truck, three cars. Everyone else was fine. So 4 paramedics worked on me. They did everything they could to try to revive me. And in spite of the best efforts, they were unsuccessful. So the body was covered up with a tarp.
Somebody, they declared you dead.
They declared me dead, all 4 of them, and they're waiting for a medical examiner to come and do the paperwork so the body can be transported for an autopsy, do an investigation about what happened to me. But the moment the truck struck me, I was absent from the body. That was just an earth suit like the one you're sitting in right now. I was in heaven. I was at one of the gates of heaven, surrounded by people I had known and loved in this life who had preceded me in death. And we were having a spectacular time. I wasn't even remotely interested about what's happening back down on the bridge. There were a lot of things happening on the bridge, but I was having the greatest reunion you could possibly imagine.
So, I mean, these are real people, people you knew. Who'd you see? What'd they look like?
Yeah, it started with my grandfather. He was standing there at the gate facing me, and he looked great. I mean, last time I saw him, he did not look great. He had a heart attack and died. I was with him when he had the heart attack. And it was just heartbreaking to be with him and watch him die, pass away, very close to him. I tell people all the time, I've broken virtually every bone in my body, and it hurt, but nothing hurts like a broken heart. And when he died, it broke my heart. A lot of you have a broken heart. I've met a lot today who are struggling with that. I met a lady just now, husband died 3 days ago. So a lot of you have broken heart. Well, I understand what that it feels, but now I'm at the gate, and here's my grandfather standing in front of me, and he looks really, really good. If you want to look really, really good, heaven is where you want to be. I mean, you look nice now, but he was even missing, because of his life of very hard labor, he was missing three fingers on one hand and two on the other, and he reached out to me and spoke verbally, and he said, "Welcome home, Donnie." Those were his words to me. That's what he used to call me here on earth, Donnie. And I looked out at the hands that used to hold me when I was a little boy, and all of his fingers were there. I'd never seen them before. He was really kind of ageless. He was perfect, fully recognizable as himself, but in a beautiful and perfect kind of way. He obviously knew I was coming. Everybody did. You don't sneak up on heaven. Everybody up there knows it's coming.
Well, what was that like? What did you feel like in your body? What did it feel like? You said your grandfather ended up hugging you. What does that feel like?
Unspeakable joy. There really aren't any words for it. One of the most frustrating things about talking about heaven is we don't have earthly words to do it justice.
You can see miles away.
The vision is almost incomprehensible because, well, it's like all the questions people ask about heaven, and there are good questions, but in heaven you would never ask a question about heaven. You know. You just know. So there's no questions are not necessary because of your sight, because of your senses. Heaven's a sensory explosion, really, for all of our senses, touch and sound. I didn't taste anything, but I know if I did, it would have been wonderful. The music was my most vivid memory of heaven. I wouldn't have thought that before it happened. I mean, I am musical. I like music. But there were thousands of songs at the same time without chaos. Now, here on earth, two songs at the same time could be pretty chaotic. But in heaven, you're going to hear thousands of songs at the same time and distinguish each one of them with your heavenly ears. And what I wanted to do when everything stopped was just to cry out, "God, what's happening? I just got here." I never got to even say that because before I uttered anything, I heard a voice out of this darkness. And the darkness was a tarp in a car. And the man behind me was a preacher who came from the same conference, and he was singing "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." And as he sang it, I started singing with him in the dark. And he got out of the car and said, really fast, got out of the car, and said, "The dead man is singing." And I was.
90 minutes.
Okay. By the way, that was supposed to be a video. You were supposed to see him talking to the guy, but that didn't happen. So let's go back here, and that was Don Piper. Here's a shorter clip, and this is a, these are pretty intellectual people. One was a spinal surgeon. She was trapped below a turned over kayak and was drowning. And because she was a physician, she said, I knew intellectually what was happening each step that my body was shutting down. And she had a near-death experience, and this other guy is a spinal surgeon. And let's hear what they have to say. Oh, got to go back here. I think PowerPoint will figure this out someday. Let's see if the video works this time.
What's travel like in heaven?
You know,
what did you experience?
I probably walked, but I feel like I moved in some cases without walking. I don't even feel like you have to. I think if you want to be over there, you can be over there. I think it's
just
that
with
way.
Thought?
Yeah, just because that's where you want to be. So I don't know that movement there is necessarily like it is here. I think we still have our arms and legs, and I think we're the way that God made us. But I don't know that travel or movement or anything is necessarily like this. I did sense that I was, when the crowd parted and I'm going through the gates, that I was moving. I don't really specifically remember walking. I may have, but I wasn't paying attention to that. I was paying attention to my goal, which was high and lifted up. I wanted to go up there and fall at his feet and tell him thank you for letting me come. So I did move. I would say movement in heaven is not like it is here.
We weren't physically walking, but I would agree that there are different types of travel, because we were moving down this pathway, not locomoting, but gliding, I suppose. But as we were going down the pathway, I was still able to hear the guys on the riverbank and see them. And one of the guys, who at the time was only 18, he's a very young man, a very dear friend of ours, he kept calling to me to come back and take a breath. And I would look back, and he looked so vulnerable and so devastated that I would say, oh, just a minute, I'll be right back. And the people who were taking me were very patient and understanding, and I would almost immediately be back in my body, and I would take a breath.
Like by thought, you were just there?
Right. And then I would...
Okay, I think I froze up again. I have to restart the program. I guess PowerPoint does not like my embedded softwares. Here's something interesting. There's evidence that the Apostle Paul had a near-death experience. In Acts 14, we hear about Paul being beat up and left for dead outside the city gates. But Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having persuaded the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing that he was dead. But when the disciples gathered about him, he rose up and entered the city, and on the next day, he went with Barnabas to Derbe. In 2 Corinthians, Paul writes, and this is about himself. He said, I know a man in Christ who was 14 years ago and was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in body or out of body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into a paradise, whether in body or out of body, I do not know. God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. In other words, he did not have the ability to explain the experience that he had when he had this experience. So it was very akin to what we hear in near-death experiences. This next guy was a pilot. He was a pilot that just plowed headfirst into this monument and was just left dead. So I'm going to try one more time, well, two more times, to see if we can get a good response. See if it'll play the video.
And as soon as I'm thinking, go back, the angel moved just to the side. But I looked into the eyes of the warmest, kindest, most wonderful. I knew this was the Son of God. I knew this was my Savior. And all of a sudden, my knees buckled, my legs lost their strength, and I just went down. I couldn't stand. I was not worthy to. I was not worthy to stand in his presence. Funny that I didn't feel worthy to be in heaven, yet I knew I was worthy in the early part. I was somehow given this, granted this authority, but I had this supernatural gift that I was worthy. Somebody had done something for me.
He had.
Yes. And so I'm down on my, just falling down, and I see his feet, and I grab them, and I hold his feet, and I see the scars. And I know this is the Son of God. He's my Savior. He's my Lord. It is because of him. He died for everybody. It's so cool, because the Bible even says, no, I just take that back. Jesus said that I have come not to condemn the world, but that the world through me will be saved. And it was because of that. He's not condemning anybody. It doesn't matter what you've done in your life what sins you've done, including murder. It doesn't matter what you've done. All of it is forgivable. God can forgive anybody of any.
So you can see that he's very impassioned. Do you believe he really experienced this in his near-death experience? Do you believe that he felt it was real? It's one thing, again, to read about these people. It's another thing totally to hear them. I'm going to suffer you through one more video. His PowerPoint is bombed again on me. But that's down the road a little bit. How many of you have seen the movie Heaven is for Real? Anybody seen it? Okay, so you know about this little boy, Colin Burpo, who had a near-death experience. He had an emergency appendectomy. He was declared dead. He came back with all sorts of stories. He says, "Yeah, I met Granddad," and he had never met his granddad. And they started to go through old pictures of Granddad, and he said, "No, that's not Granddad. That's not Granddad." But then they came up with a picture of his granddad as a younger man, and he said, "That's Granddad." So he was not manifest in Burpo's experience as an old man, but yet as a young, vibrant man. One of the things he said, "Yeah, I met Jesus." And the question is, well, who was this Jesus that you met? And they started to show him a bunch of pictures of Jesus. "Here are some of the pictures that I garnered off the web." And he said, "No, that wasn't him. No, that wasn't him. No, that wasn't him. No, that wasn't him." But one day his mom and dad were taking him through a Christian bookstore, and he saw a picture, and he said, "That's him. That's Jesus." Now, this goes back to this savant lady named Akian Kramerik, who used to have visions and was just a savant artist. And she painted a picture of Christ as she saw him from one of her visions. And this is what she said Christ looked like. And this is what little Colin Burpo said independently. "Yeah, that's Jesus. That's the guy that I met." That gives me a little bit of chills. Is it true, 100% true? I don't know, but it certainly is a compelling story. Now, all of this is from a Christian perspective. What about from a secular perspective? Well, if you're interested, there is a book written by Bruce Grayson. He's a medical doctor who spent his entire life studying near-death experiences. He actually started the first journal on near-death experiences. He organized the first conference on near-death experiences and was just an expert. And he retired after 40 years. And after 40 years, he concluded the mind is different from the brain. And he says there are conjectures, but there's no standing theory explaining near-death experiences. Wow. So if you're interested in the secular point of view that coincides with John Burke's Christian point of view, read Bruce Grayson, and you'll find out the correlations are really, really amazing, even from a secular point of view. So here's some interesting statistics. Grayson said in his studies that there were 90% had a feeling of peace in their near-death experiences. 75% feelings of joy or bliss, unspeakable joy. 2/3 sensed a feeling of cosmic unity. 75% reported an encounter with a loving being of light. And 25% had a life review. This was from a secular psychiatrist. There was another study that was thousands of people who said that the experience was definitely real. 962 said it was definitely real. It was just like they lived it. It was not a dream. It was not an illusion. It was something that was totally real. So the last clip I want to play for you, and I'm sorry that the videos aren't turning out. I should have checked this before. But this is a guy that had a near-death experience and went to hell. Now, Dick talked about demons. You'll hear about demons in here.
I had known from some time in that afternoon that I was dying. I knew absolutely. But I didn't want to die because I was an atheist, and I was terrified of it because dying means the end of everything. I was a 38-year-old college professor. My work was shown in some museums, you know, I'd won some prizes, you know, I had a wife and two kids and, you know, a career, and And you know, one of the thoughts that kept going through, how could this happen? How can this possibly happen? It's not supposed to happen. Mm. And I went unconscious. I awoke from that. And I felt wonderful, unlike I'd ever felt in my entire life.
Wait, so you knew you died, and suddenly you felt great?
Well, I didn't know I'd died. I'd been unconscious, and now I feel great, you know?
And where were you?
Standing next to the bed, upright, and the first thing, I was like, why do I feel so good? I just felt the worst I'd ever felt in my entire life.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't breathe, and now I'm like Superman, and my eyesight, my hearing, my taste, my smell, and I'm thinking about my senses, and I can...
So you still don't know you're dead?
No.
And you feel alive? You feel good?
I feel good. More alive than I've ever felt in my entire life. And I heard people calling me in English, kind of nicely, you know, Howard, come here. So I go over to the doorway of the room, and in the hallway is gray. It's very unclear, like a terrible black and white TV picture. And there's men and women standing far away from the light of the doorway. And I said, I'm sick, I need to have surgery, I've been waiting all day for a doctor. And they said, we know all about you, hurry, come with us now. We can't wait any longer, come, hurry. As we went, it got darker and darker, and they came in closer and closer, and more of them were around me. And now, as I asked them questions like, where are we going, how much further, things like that, they started to become more rude and say things to me like, shut up. Don't ask questions. You'll find out. You don't need to know. Keep moving. Move it. You know, like that. And I'm like getting pretty intimidated. That becomes fear. That becomes terror. And what they were doing was just playing with me, toying with me. And at first it was pushing, kicking, pulling, hitting, and then that became biting and tearing with their fingernails and hands. And they were taking pieces of me. And there was a lot of laughter, a lot of very foul language. And then they became more invasive. And I don't ever go further with this because it was so demeaning. I mean, I don't talk about it any further. And in that place, I heard a voice which I identify as my voice, except that it did not come out of my throat, off my lips. But I do feel, it's strange, but I feel like it came out of my chest. This voice said, pray to God. And I thought, I don't believe in God. I don't pray. The voice said, pray to God. And I thought, I don't even know how to pray. I couldn't pray if I wanted to pray. The voice said, pray to God.
But you couldn't find one at that point?
Well, I found the Lord is my shepherd. And then I found later, yea, though I walk through the valley of death, I'll fear no evil. Stuff like that. And our Father who art in heaven. I remember like these phrases out of prayers. And I start to mutter this stuff, and the people around me absolutely can't bear it. Now, this made me want to pray more, because for the first time I was able to hit back at them. The prayers were like clobbering. This is the horrible part, that the people that had met me were my kindred spirit. Now, I do not know if I knew any of those people in this world prior to this experience. That's not what I'm trying to say. They were my brothers and sisters in spirit.
What do you mean by that?
They denied God. They lived for themselves. And their lives were about manipulation and control of other people. As a son to my mother and father, I had failed them. My father and I had no relationship, and my poor mother, because my dad and I not speaking to each other, she was, you know, we couldn't have any, much of a relationship. I hardly ever saw her. I had very poor relationship with my sisters. I had not been a good husband to my wife, and you can use your imagination to figure out what that means. But that's true. That's all true. I had not been the father to my kids that I should have been, and I knew I hadn't because I was busy. I was trying to be somebody, you know, like the football games and the band concerts and the choral concerts and the theater performances. That could all wait because I was busy being important. I was doing stuff, making myself into somebody. In that, this memory comes of myself as a little boy sitting in a Sunday school classroom singing Jesus Loves Me. Why would he care? He must hate me. I'm so sorry. And I thought, enough of this. I'm done. I don't have anything else. Jesus, please save me. And when I said that, I saw light, tiny little speck of light, and it very rapidly got very bright and came over me. And I saw out of the light hands and arms emerge out of this impossibly beautiful white light. And these hands and arms came out, and they reached down and they touched me. And when they touched me, in that light, I could see me and all the gore, and I was roadkill, all that gore began to just dissolve, and I became whole. And much more significantly to me than was the physical healing was that I was experiencing a love that is beyond, far beyond words. I've never been able to articulate it, but I can say that if I took all my experience of love in my entire life and could condense it into a moment, it still wouldn't begin to measure up to the intensity of this love that I was feeling. And when
okay,
those arms went on me and healed me, they went behind my back.
So you can see what Dick was talking about in terms of demons. They were there in this gentleman's situation. They were taking him to hell, and like he said, they were kindred spirits. So I don't know if anybody of you were familiar with the recent motion picture After Death from Angel Studios. Anybody see that? Nobody saw it? Okay, it was basically an overview. I would not recommend the movie, though. I would recommend going to the YouTube and finding out the 6-part series by John Burke on Imagine Heaven, where he interviews these people, and that's incredibly compelling. I talked to a neurologist, a materialistic neurologist named Tononi at University of Wisconsin, and we talked about near-death experiences. He says, you know what? I can take somebody and I can slip them some LSD or some peyote, and they're going to experience this out-of-death experience also. But there are aspects of near-death experiences which are inexplicable. For example, people who were blind since birth, who in their near-death experiences saw themselves. They had these out-of-body experiences. They were in the operating room. They saw what was happening below. One of the surgeons challenged a girl. She said, I don't think that you had a near-death experience. And she says, oh, yeah. He says, you didn't wear your shoe coverings. When you're a surgeon, you're supposed to wear shoe coverings. And then she pointed to another one and says, you have a really foul mouth, because this guy was cursing her or something during the operation. They're also able to see things outside on the top of roofs that don't have any access other than by, a drone, for example, taking photographs. And these are just inexplicable from somebody taking LSD or a peyote mushroom. So the near-death experiences are true. Bruce Grayson believes they're true. John Burke believes they're true. When I first heard about this, I thought it was a bunch of hooey. But now I think that the evidence is so overwhelming that near-death experiences are indeed true. So I'm reminded of the 1 Corinthians 15 that says, "Oh death, where is thy sting?" Because these people that come back from near-death experiences are no longer afraid to die. They have no fear of death. And I think for older people like me, it's really comforting to see this evidence that indeed heaven does exist. Now, this is just one of the aspects of what we talk about in terms of whether the mind is greater than the body. This is covered in a book called Minding the Brain. It's edited by Angus Manoj, Brian Krause, and me. It was just released last month. And it has a number of chapters which deal with why the mind is greater than the brain. And yeah, if you're interested in it, it's pretty thick stuff. Some of the philosophy gets, you know, just really rough, but there's some really good chapters in there, including one on near-death experiences. There's a chapter by J.P. Moreland that we talked about, and a number of other good things. Okay, that concludes my presentation. Thank you for listening.